Good day and welcome to Dr. Hugh Ross's Paradox of Sunday School class. Dr. Ross is with us today. He's going to be talking about the Christmas star and Middle East scholars dealing with that. He'll be with us in a moment. And for me, I want to thank you all who prayed for me. I had an RSV, my wife and I did. And by the way, that stands for respiratory syncytial virus. So it's like a flu, but worse. It knocked me down. I lost about 15 pounds, too, so, which isn't so bad, but it wasn't fun doing it. So I recommend the shot. It is a messenger RNA shot. So, you know, some of you are sensitive to that, but if you can do it, it's worth it. There won't be any class next week, Sunday. We're going to be dark for honoring Christmas. But we will meet the following Sunday, the 5th. So we're closed on the 29th of December, but we'll be here on the 5th of January. And we just want to thank all the folks that brought treats. We have a lot of extra Christmas stuff. We just need the late folks to get here now. And especially thanks to Tim and Valerie for bringing all the treats. And with that, let me say a prayer. Heavenly Father, we especially thank you for the Christmas revelation, the sacrificial giving of your only Son for remission of our sins and allowing us entry into your kingdom. Bless Dr. Ross's message today. Bless us, Lord, that we may be better prepared in our witnessing endeavors. We ask this in Jesus' name, amen. Dr. Ross, come on up, please.
Well, I managed to avoid the RSV because I actually took the shot. And, you know, it takes you down for a day, but I was still able to work during that day. And I've met a lot of people like you, Mark and Val, who've had it. And it's not fun. So it's worth getting the shot. They say if you're over 60, get the shot. And if you got any doubts, I really am over 60. Okay. And a few days ago, I had dinner with a couple we know from a Hollywood ministry. And they were sharing with me, you've got to see this new movie that's out. It's a movie on Mary. And they really did a lot of research to make sure that they got the history just right. So last night, my wife and I watched the movie, and they needed to read their Bible a little more carefully. So I don't know who they consulted, but they got the part about Herod wrong. They got the part about the wise men wrong. They got the part about the Christmas star wrong. So I think you'll get questions during this Christmas time about what the Bible says about this. I've just noticed the Christmas star gives me a lot of opportunities as an astronomer to use the story of the Christmas star as a bridge to present people with the gospel of what the real meaning of Christmas is all about. So here goes. The wise men were from the east. And the wise men is a term that you see in the book of Daniel. It's translated magi in the Greek. But the greatest of the wise men was Daniel. He served as prime minister of both the Babylonian Empire and the Persian Empire. It's an unprecedented event in history where the prime minister of a kingdom that was conquered was made prime minister of the kingdom that actually conquered that kingdom. So it just shows you something of the talent and the esteem with which Daniel was held, that when the Persians defeated the Babylonian Empire, they immediately made the prime minister of the Babylonian Empire the prime minister of the Persian Empire. And you can read all about it in the book of Daniel. But the wise men of the East, I believe they all studied the writings of the greatest of the wise men, Daniel. And Daniel is the only book in the Bible that predicts the timing of the coming of the Messiah. It's in the 9th chapter, verses 24, 25, 26, and 27. And basically what you see in that passage, Daniel is given a prophecy by this angel that visits him. And says, there will be a period of 483 years from the issuing of a decree to rebuild the city of Jerusalem and the coming of the Messiah. And so wise men that were studying the book of Daniel would have been aware, at least approximately, of the timing of the coming of the Messiah based on what Daniel wrote in the ninth chapter. However, they wouldn't have an exact time because there are actually three decrees that the Persian Empire wrote for the rebuilding of Jerusalem and the temple. Now, the three decrees were over a period of about 7 years, but nevertheless, you can imagine the wise men saying, well, is it this decree or that decree or that decree? But at least they had a window in which they could be looking for some kind of evidence that this was a sign of the coming of the Messiah. Now, it tells us in some translations that they were astrologers. And, you know, when I speak in churches and at university campuses, I'm actually more frequently introduced as an astrologer than I am as an astronomer. And I always have to correct, there's a difference between astronomy and astrology. I'm not an astrologer. But you know what's even funnier is that I actually get introduced much more frequently as a cosmetologist than I do as a cosmologist. And I remember this one event I was at, there were all these ladies in the audience scratching their head and saying, this is the most complex talk I've ever heard on cosmetology. So, and there was a cosmetologist in the audience who was actually afterwards complimented on the fact that I had, quote, a young-looking face. So I said, thank you. But the talk is really about cosmology, the origin and history of the universe. But back to the story. These men in the East would have been students of the book of Daniel, so they knew the timing, and they were looking for a sign. And yes, they were aware of events in the sky, and they said that they saw a star. And based on that star, they mounted an expedition to find this Messiah. And they knew that the Messiah was going to be born somewhere in the land of Israel. So what I find remarkable about the faith of these wise men is that they see this star. They knew it's a sign that it's approximately referring to the timing of the coming of the Messiah, and they mount an expedition to go to Israel, having no idea where in Israel they're going to be able to find this newborn king, this Messiah. And so, but they figure, well, the place to go is Jerusalem. That's where the temple is. Surely somebody there will know where this Messiah will be born. And so they come into Jerusalem, and what does the text tell us in the gospel? It says that when they arrived in Jerusalem, the entire city was stirred up by the arrival of these wise men. Now, how many of you have ever gotten a Christmas card that shows three guys on camels coming in to Bethlehem? If it was just three guys on camels, it wouldn't have caused a stir. Moreover, they were coming with valuable gifts. So given that they were coming with very valuable gifts to present, they would need more than three guys on camels to be safe on this long journey. Because at that time, there were pirates in the land, and they would take advantage of any caravans, and they would rob the caravans. So it's quite likely that these wise men came with a large armed entourage. Yes.
Could I interrupt for just 1 second?
Yes.
There's a car out in the lot whose emergency lights are blinking. So license 7DGT511. So if you don't want to have a dead battery, you better get out there.
Okay, I think we know whose car that was. So, you know, it's a funny thing about this church, there's a lot outside. It's supposed to be reserved for old people, but I always walk from the faraway lot because I'm not old yet, so but that time will come when I'll need to park in that lot, and I'll try to remember to make sure that the emergency lights are turned off. But yeah, back to the story. So, the whole city Jerusalem was stirred up by the arrival of these wise men. So we're probably looking at several hundred people being part of this entourage. That would have been sufficient to guarantee that as they traveled from the east across the desert, they would be able to defend themselves against robbers and be able to present this. And so they come into Jerusalem and they engage Herod. They engage the leaders in the temple and say, tell us, where is this king to be born? And it was the priests within the temple that said, oh, the book of Micah tells us. Micah 5:2 says he'll come from Bethlehem. And so now they not only knew the time, they knew the location. But again, I want to commend the faith of the wise men. They actually mounted this expensive expedition across the desert from the east into Jerusalem, not even knowing where this newborn child, this king, would be. But they had the hope that if they got to Jerusalem, someone in the temple priests, would be able to tell them where to look. And this is a time when the land of Israel had a population of about 5 million people. So it wouldn't have been easy just to kind of, you know, scout around and say where it is. They needed help. But yeah, now they knew it was going to be in Bethlehem. Now that was fortuitous for them because Bethlehem was a small village. You know, my wife and I visited that village in 1980. It's still today quite a small place. But back then it was even smaller. And so now that they knew it was going to be a small village, it would not be a big difficulty for them to find a couple with a firstborn son. And so they were looking for someone, and they saw the star, and so they would know approximately how old this child would be based on how long it took him to come. And notice what the gospel account tells us. As they were about to head towards Bethlehem, they had a conversation with Herod. And Herod quizzed him very carefully about the star. Now, this is significant. Evidently, he had no clue about the star. That's significant based on people's speculations about the star. In fact, the movie we watched last night, it featured the star multiple times in the movie, and that star was way brighter than Venus, the brightest object in the sky today besides the moon and the sun. And if it was that bright, Herod would say, oh yeah, I know about that star. But what the text tells us, he did not know what the star was. So it was obscure enough that Herod and the religious leaders were unaware of what they were talking about. We saw this star, and so then Herod very says, well, tell me exactly when did you see the star? And notice what the text says. Based on the information he got from the wise men, he sent the wise men on their way to Bethlehem and said, return when you find the child and come to me, because I too want to worship him. Now, the story of Herod, this is very well portrayed in the movie we saw last night, just what an evil individual he was. He was basically even killing his own relatives who were a threat to his rule over the land of Judea. And so his intent was, when I find this child, I'm going to take out that child. That was his real intent. So that's why he says, go and find the child. Come back so that I too may worship him. Now, what do we notice is that when the wise men presented their gifts to Joseph and Mary, and those gifts, by the way, were crucial for them to be able to escape the terror of King Herod, they had a dream, and they were warned in a dream, do not go back to King Herod, go back to the country. So they avoided going back to Jerusalem and took the shortcut and went back to their own land. And when Herod heard about this, he was furious. And so what did he do? He rounded up a team of soldiers and said, go to Bethlehem and kill every firstborn son that you find there, 2 years of age or younger. So he's saying, well, and see, he already knew from the wise men how much time had passed since they first saw the star. And so knowing that time, and I'm guessing they probably told him it was about a year and a half ago. So a year and a half, he added 6 months just to be safe. And he killed all the firstborn children who were males in the city of Bethlehem. And we were told that there was great crying from the people in Bethlehem for what they suffered at Herod's hand. And then also we know that Joseph and Mary, they too were warned, do not go back to Jerusalem, don't go back to Nazareth, you need to head to Egypt. And they were able to get to Egypt because of the gifts that they had received from the Magi. And so they were able to use those gifts to get to Egypt, and they're told when they're in Egypt, stay until King Herod is gone. And King Herod died probably a couple of years later. So they actually had the means, thanks to the wise men, because after all, Joseph and Mary were not wealthy. They were poor. But thanks to the gifts they got from the wise men, they were able to get to Egypt, stay there until King Herod died, and then go back to Nazareth and reestablish their life there in Nazareth, with Joseph being the carpenter there. Okay, what about the star? Now, what it tells us, we get another detail. They saw the star in the east, and they began their journey, and the star disappeared. So again, it says something about the faith of the Magi. The star had disappeared. Nevertheless, they continued their journey to go to Jerusalem to find the location. But as they're on their way from Jerusalem to Bethlehem, the star reappeared. Now, some of your English translations of the text of Matthew will make the point that the star pointed the way to where the newborn child was, the Messiah. The Greek word there, it's a verb, it's histeme. It's got 30 different literal definitions. And there's nothing that actually tells us that the star had any pointing value at all. In fact, I can tell you as an astronomer, no star can point you. The stars move around as the Earth rotates. So stars do not point. But however, the star reassured the wise men they were on the right track. So the star reappeared, says they're overjoyed. It confirmed to them they were not wasting their time. As they're on the way to Bethlehem, the star reappeared and they said, okay, we're confident now. We're going to be able to find this child, and we're going to be able to present our gifts and worship him. And so they did, and they're on their way. Okay, what is this star? Now, there's probably 40 books that you can buy on the Christmas star, and the vast majority of those books do not get the star right. 90% of them claim that the star was a conjunction of planets. And you say, what's a conjunction of planets? It's where two planets in the sky actually come close together, and occasionally they come close enough together that they become a single object in the sky. Because that's interesting. When you look at Matthew, it doesn't say it was two stars. It uses the word star singular. So it's a single event. And that rules out all the explanations you see. Well, maybe it was Jupiter and Saturn coming together, or Jupiter and Venus coming together. But if that were really the case, the vast majority of conjunctions, and I've seen dozens of them in my life, the planets come close together, but not close enough together to look like a single star with the naked eye. You can usually see significant separation. A really good conjunction is one where the two planets are closer together than, say, three moon diameters in the sky. So we call that a conjunction. Now, so are there any conjunctions at the time of Jesus that are close enough together where it would appear to be one star? There is one, only one. That's Venus and Jupiter coming together in 1 AD. Now, the problem with that date is Herod died before 1 AD. He died in 4 AD, or 4 BC. So you have the star, Venus, and Jupiter come close together where they would appear as one star in 1 BC. But that's not appropriate because the text is clear that Herod died before the star appeared, several years before the star appeared. Moreover, Venus and Jupiter, Venus moves pretty fast in the sky. And so they come together and look as one star for only about an hour. And by the way, it's not in the land of Israel. It's thousands of miles away where people would see it as a single star. So for two reasons, we can rule out Venus and Jupiter. I say that because the best-selling book on the Christmas star, that's the claim, is Jupiter and Saturn, Jupiter and Venus coming together in 1 BC. But now they got to kind of deal with the history problem because we already have Herod dead in 4 BC. And they say, well, maybe the date is not accurate, but the date cannot be any less uncertain than plus or minus 2 years. And even that will not get you to 1 BC. So, however, Jupiter and Venus are the two brightest planets in the sky. If that indeed was a Christmas star, Herod would have said, oh yeah, I know what you're talking about. And the religious leaders in the temple would say, oh yeah, we know what you're talking about. But the text is clear, they did not know what they were talking about. Now, that also rules out other explanations, that it's a bright comet. If it was a bright comet, people would know all about it. Bright comets were very highly publicized events at the time of Jesus. And so again, you can't explain the fact that Herod and the religious leaders had no idea what this star was all about. And it can't be a supernova. The interesting thing about supernova is that they actually can get bright enough as you can see them in the daytime. But it was a supernova, again, Herod would say, yeah, we know exactly what you're talking about. Another strike against supernova is they can't reappear. You only see them once. And that was the reason why a lot of people like the conjunctions, because there are occasions where, say, you get Jupiter and Saturn coming close together, separating and coming close together again, and at about the right time frame of a year and a half. However, the text says a star. It's a single star. So, and again, if we're talking Jupiter and Saturn, or Jupiter and Mars coming close together, separating and coming back close together a year and a half later, Herod would have known all about it. Likewise, the religious leaders, because everybody was watching the movements of the planets. They're called the wandering stars. Stars don't move relative to one another. The planets do as they orbit about the sun. The planets are bright, and people would be very familiar with those movements. So what is the Christmas star? Well, there are two kinds of stellar events where the star appears, disappears from visibility, and reappears with the right time frame of, say, a year to 2 years. One would be what's called a cataclysmic variable star. And that's a star that will explode, and the explosion dies away, and it re-explodes again. Matter of fact, there's a news story going about that sometime this month or next month, there's a variable star in the constellation Corona Borealis. It's one of these cataclysmic variable stars. It's predicted to go cataclysmic again, which means, and right now you can't see it, even with a pair of binoculars. However, it'll probably get as bright as a star Polaris sometime in the next few weeks. And that's a big deal because it only happens about once every 70 or 80 years. So if you miss this one, you got to wait a long time to see it again. So I'm looking forward to it because, seeing, and what it is, it's a star that basically comes, it'll be the brightest star in the constellation Corona Borealis when it goes. Another candidate is what they call a recurring nova. A nova is not a supernova, and most novae only happen once. The star explodes, it goes invisible, and stays invisible. But there's a special kind of nova where there's another partner star orbiting around it. So you got this old, burnt-out star, and you got a smaller star orbiting around it, and they orbit close enough that the nova star can steal mass away from the star that's orbiting about it. And this mass accumulates on its surface, and what that does, it ignites an explosion. And so astronomers have been seeing these recurring nova, where say every 30 years, they see a flash. And where it's different, with the recurring nova, it comes at the same brightness every time. The cataclysmic variable star, it can be bright or dim. You do get these repeated eruptions, but they're not all the same brightness. With a recurring nova, The recurrence is the same brightness as the former one, and it's periodic. So it's a regular period. With a cataclysmic variable stars, it's a bit variable, 70, 80 years. But with a recurring nova, it's always the same period of time. And so it's a star that appears, disappears, and reappears. Now, I've been basically saying for 50 years now, I think the Christmas star is a recurring nova. 50, 40, 30, even 10 years ago, I got pushback from my fellow astronomers who said, yeah, great idea. However, we have yet to see a recurring nova with a period as short as about a year and a half. They're all more than 10 years. 10 years, 100 years, 200 years. However, what's happened in the last decade? Astronomers have found two recurring nova, one with a period of 14 months, one with a period of 10 months. So we now are seeing recurring nova with about the right period. Now, if you look at the astronomical records of the astronomers at that time, and keep in mind back at the time of Jesus, the nations of the world invested more heavily in astronomical research than nations do today. You know, people complain, NASA gets almost 1% of the federal budget. However, the nations of the ancient world invested much more heavily, as heavily as 25% of their government national budget went for astronomy research. And so the nations of the world were employing astronomers, literally to watch the skies. But there was a small contingent of astronomers whose job it was to find guest stars. A guest star is a star that shows up in a constellation where it's never been before. Today we call them novae. And so you look at a constellation. In fact, when I was an amateur astronomer during my teenage years, we had a team of amateurs that would look at the constellations every night to see if they saw something that wasn't there the night before. If we see something, we know we've discovered a nova. So how often does that happen? Well, if you're diligently studying the sky, you'll see with the naked eye about one of those every 2 or 3 years. And so with a telescope, of course, you can see literally dozens of them per year. But with the naked eye, you can pick up one about every 1, 2, 3, or 4 years. And so in the ancient world, people were actually commissioned to look for, quote, guest stars, a star that showed up where the star hadn't then been there before. So are there any astronomical records of a guest star that could fit the Christmas star we see recorded in the book of Matthew? There's only one. It's in the Korean astronomical records. They report the appearance of a star that was almost as bright as Polaris in 5 BC. And the best accepted date for the birth of Jesus is 4 BC plus or minus 1 year, so it's in the right time frame. But as we look at the Korean records, they did not report a reoccurrence. So maybe, maybe not. But I think a recurring nova is basically explaining what was going on with the Christmas star. It appeared, disappeared for about a year and a half, reappeared when the wise men were on their journey from Jerusalem to Bethlehem. They presented their gifts. The star disappeared. They went back and headed back to their homeland. And meanwhile, we got King Herod coming into Bethlehem, killing all the young boys, firstborn boys, that were 2 years of age younger. But before that happened, thanks to the gifts they got from the wise men, Mary and Joseph, and the newborn king went off to Egypt and stayed there until Herod died. Okay, I'll take a time for a couple, well, just one question from the audience here. We're gonna have a Q&A time afterwards, then we'll get into our study on what's going on with the Middle Ages. So, yeah, that very well-researched movie, I don't think it was quite the well-researched. And it was a bit disturbing because I saw the names of all the people they consulted, and some of those names involved really quite famous pastors. So again, good idea to read the book of Matthew, read it in detail, and compare it with the book of Daniel. Okay, do you have a question? Yes, go for it.
Yeah, and Matt, you're talking about Matthew chapter 2 with the... Go ahead. Yeah. Okay. Matthew chapter 2, where, you know, the wise men come, and one of the things it says about the star is that it came to rest over the place where he was and something like that. So maybe you could describe what that situation is.
Yeah, that's the verb estemi I was referring to, because, yeah, several English translations will say the star pointed to where the baby rested, or stood over where the baby rested. And, yeah, that's possible translations of the verb histeme. But in an article I've written on the Christmas star, I give you all the lexical definitions for the word histeme. And one of them could be simply appeared. So given that it's got 30 different definitions, it has a very broad meaning, so be careful about what you read there. And the whole point is, anytime you read the Bible, if you want the scientific and historical details, you really need to read it in the original language. You say, well, I'm not fluent in Greek, I'm not fluent in Hebrew. You don't have to be. The wonderful thing about speaking English is in the 21st century, we got these amazing Hebrew and Greek Bible aids that are all available online. So you can go online and look up that word where it says it pointed or, you know, sat upon or showed the way. You can look up the original Greek word. You can go to a lexicon and get the full definition of that word. You can do all that without having to take a course in Greek. And you can even analyze the grammar of the sentence if you want to without having to take a course in Greek. Now, the advantage of being fluent in Greek, you can figure it out right away. If you're not fluent, it might take you 30 minutes to actually figure out exactly what that sentence is saying. But hey, a course in Greek will take you a whole year. You only have to spend half an hour to figure it all out. Okay, another question?
Yeah, my question would be what instrumentation they might have had that would have told them that, you know, they had a accurate enough analysis of where the star was to point to where the child was.
Okay, I think what was going on with the wise men in the East is they were looking at the heavens for some possible sign that would indicate which decree that they should pay attention to figure out the timing of the coming of the Messiah. Because after all, three decrees, you're looking at plus or minus 3 years. So seeing a star that wasn't there before, and the interesting thing about a nova event, it's rare. As I said, with the naked eye, you might go. And for example, if you look at the ancient records of the Japanese, the Chinese, the Korean, the Babylonian, the Egyptian astronomers, the German astronomers, if you look at all those ancient records, how many times do you see a report of a guest star? It shows up about once every 10 or 20 years. So the fact that they're using the naked eye, because there could be one that shows up that they miss. If you don't have, say, 100 amateurs looking at the sky every night, you might miss it. So if we're talking something that happens only once every 10 or 20 years, the fact that they saw a new star, especially if it was as bright as, say, Polaris, second magnitude, that might be enough for them to say, hey, this is not only a new star, it's about the brightest of these new guest stars that can possibly happen. They say, we think this is evidence. Let's go to Jerusalem. So I think that's the context of what we're seeing here.
Hugh, there's several more Christmas star questions. Do you want to save them for later?
Oh, okay.
Okay. Anybody else in the audience?
Online group? Okay.
Online. We got online questions. By the way, Doug McComb just wanted to thank everybody for the prayers for him and his wife getting over COVID. And he recommends the drug Pavlovid. Said it worked very well for his COVID.
So. Okay.
Okay, here's one from, can't quite read it. Anyway. So they stayed in Bethlehem until the Magi arrived and before Herod massacred the firstborn. Did Joseph run out of relatives to accommodate them in Bethlehem?
Yeah, good question. You know, also the in story probably doesn't get it quite right. We all say there is no room at the inn. You hear that all the time about the Joseph and Mary and Jesus. The Greek word for inn doesn't necessarily mean hotel. It just means a place where you can lodge. And as it tells us in the Matthew, there was basically the whole world was being taxed. And so Joseph had to go to his hometown in order to sign the registry and be taxed. Well, given that it was hometown, there were probably relatives he could stay with. However, the entire Roman world is being taxed, so everybody is on the move to go back to their hometown. I think a more likely scenario of what was going on with Joseph and Mary and Jesus is they come to their hometown, Bethlehem, but a whole bunch of their relatives also comes to Bethlehem. The entire extended family descends on Bethlehem. And because they arrive a little later, all the rooms are filled. So I think that's really what's going on. There's no room for them to stay amongst all of their relatives. And so they basically find a place downstairs with the animals. And typically the way homes were constructed back then in Bethlehem, the family lived upstairs, their animals were downstairs. And so all the room upstairs was filled with the relatives of Joseph. But they said, well, you can stay downstairs with the animals. So they stayed downstairs with the animals. Now, he registers, he pays his tax, and he is told to stay in Bethlehem. And so he just basically finds a relative he can stay with. And that would be relatively easy because the rest of his relatives would go back to their homes. And so now there was empty rooms where they could stay. But when they first got there, when Jesus was born, the place was packed with all the relatives of Joseph, all there getting to register and pay their taxes. And so after they all left, there'd be room. And we don't know how much time transpired between the first arrival of Joseph, Mary, and Jesus, and when they left. It could have been just a few days. It could have been a few weeks. But yes, they're told, escape to Egypt. And so, and hey, given that it's their relatives, they probably say, hey, can you stay a few days before you head back to Nazareth? We haven't seen you in a long while. So chances are they probably stayed for a while. Exactly how long, we don't know. And then they head on to Egypt. But we do know they probably stayed in Egypt a while. They were told to stay in Egypt until Herod was dead. And then they waited a while to see who would take the throne. Because after all, they were worried about Herod's descendants. Who was going to take the throne? And when they were encouraged, hey, the one taking the throne is one that's not as dangerous as his brothers. You can go back to Nazareth. So they head back to Nazareth. So yeah, you might want to change the story about there's no room at the inn. Chances are they went to one of their relatives' homes, and there was no room upstairs, but there was room downstairs where they could stay with the animals. And then the shepherds came. And so the shepherds were there the night that Jesus was born. The wise men were not. They came about a year and a half later. But again, that year and a half would be a year and a half from the time they saw the star in the east. How long they took to journey to Judah, we don't know. They would have had to raise a large contingent to protect them on the way, so it could have been many months before they started their journey, then they took their journey. So a lot of the times that we think of are not well determined, exactly how long. So it could have been that Joseph and Mary were literally only in Bethlehem for a couple of days and then left. And then how much time was between the shepherds and the wise men, we don't know. It's possible they're all there in the same night, but it's much more likely that the wise men came later than the shepherds. So, because after all, no, sorry. If it's a year and a half, they came a year and a half later, and the shepherds were there right away. So, because after all, again, Herod questioned them, said, tell me when you saw the star. The sighting of the star would be when Jesus was born. And it's also interesting that it was the most despised of people that came to visit Jesus first, the shepherds. So, and basically there's a message there that the gospel is for the clean and the unclean. Because, yeah, at that time, shepherds were considered the most unclean of people. And notice when they, what does it say in the Exodus period? That the Egyptians despise shepherds. For the simple reason, shepherds are handling sheep. They're cleaning up after the sheep. And so people were concerned about the diseases they could get from shepherds. But Jesus welcomes the lepers. He welcomes the shepherds. He welcomes everybody. Okay.
Okay, additional treats have arrived. If anybody was still hungry, come and help yourself. One more question, Hugh. Thomas Longo says, how do we reconcile the statistically improbable census counts in Numbers with biblical inerrancy?
How do we reconcile what?
How do we reconcile the statistically improbably census counts in Numbers, as capital N, with biblical inerrancy?
Well, I actually wrote about that in the flood book that's coming out, is that, you know, a lot of people think that you can look at the genealogies in the Bible and get an exact date. You can't, because every biblical genealogy is incomplete. And yeah, the problem is when you look at the Exodus, you have Jacob coming with his family, and there's 66 in his family that he comes from the land of Canaan into the land of Goshen in Egypt. And those are the male members of the family. But if you just look at the genealogy from Jacob on through to Moses, one genealogy only has four names in it. So you say four generations, and you got 66 people becoming, 3 million in just that short a period of time. And that's not conceivable that you could get a population growth that fast in just four generations. But it's more than four generations. So given the fact that names are missing, you can actually go from 66 males to nearly 3 million males in that period of time. So you're looking at several hundred years, in which case, that's not a problem. Okay, we can go to, yes, let's do that. Let's spend a few minutes looking at what we see in the Dark Ages and the Middle Ages on the flood. And this is all based on a claim of a debate I had with a global flood proponent, Terry Mortensen from Answers in Genesis, back in October. And the opening statement he made in that debate was, for the first 1,800 years of the church, all Christian scholars believed in a global flood and a young earth. And I remember him really emphasizing all, no exceptions. Well, we spent some time actually looking at what the early church fathers believed about the flood. None of them endorsed a global flood. Now, a lot of them talked about the flood being worldwide, but one of those early church fathers said, yeah, it's worldwide. He quoted 2 Peter 2:5, it's the world of ungodly people. The problem is you got people like Terry Mortensen seeing the word worldwide and presuming that meant the entire globe. It's the world of humanity. It's not the world of geography or geology. And so the question is, what did pre-scientific revolution Christian scholars really believe about Noah's flood? I'm not going to repeat what we covered about the early church fathers. We'll pick it up with one right after the early church fathers, Augustine, probably the most famous Christian scholar from the first 500 years of the church. And I'll quickly go through this because we covered it the last time we dealt with this. What you see is him claiming that Genesis 6-9 is an account of true historical events and has great allegorical significance. So Augustine basically was repeating what scholars before him had said, that namely the account in Genesis is literal, it is historical, it is true, but it also has great allegorical significance in the sense that it communicates not only a true historical event, but it's also symbolic of the gospel message. It's basically symbolic or symbolizing the coming of the Messiah to redeem us from all of our sin. We have the flood wiping out the wickedness, but we also have Noah and the ark rescuing humanity from the evil and sin around them. This is clearly symbolic. What happened before, a number on the road about all the water was symbolic of baptism. The rescue was symbolic of what Jesus would do. Augustine also said that the size of the ark and its structure was adequate for the food stores needed not only by the herbivores but by the carnivores. And this meant he understood we're not talking all the herbivores and carnivores on the surface of the earth, but we're talking about those herbivores and carnivores that are in relationship with human beings. He said, on that basis, the ark is big enough. So this is actually evidence that he was not believing in a global flood. He was believing in a flood that impacted the world of humanity. And how Noah and his family is saved by water and word, as a family of Christ is saved by baptism. Here's where he gets into the allegories. He says the ark is made of beams, as the church is constructed as saints, prepared for every good work. And he also talked about how the inclusion of all kinds of animals in the ark signifies that the church will contain members of all nations of humanity. And even the pitch, he says the pitch that's gluing together the ark's beams signifies Christians' love, which, quote, keeps brotherly connection from being impaired. Okay, and then we move a few years after Augustine. We have Cyril of Alexandria, and he writes in his commentary in the Bible, he noted the important distinction of 2 Peter 2:5. So like people went before him, he said, look at the New Testament. It says the flood was wrought upon the world of the ungodly. Not necessarily the world of the entire planet Earth. It's the world of ungodly people, the world where ungodly people lived. And then we have Theodore of Cyrus writing in 450 AD, about 30 years after Augustine. He says the account of the flood in Genesis is literal, it is historical, it is true, but it also, as Augustine said, includes moral and spiritual lessons for all humans living at all times. Okay, then moving into the Dark Ages and the Middle Ages, what do they have to say about this? Well, what we know is that they read what the early church fathers said, and then we have probably the first one, the Venerable Bede. He was writing in the 8th century AD, 720 AD, and he said, the biblical text on Noah's flood contains both a literal and a figurative message. So he's basically repeating what Augustine and people before him said, namely that the waters of creation day two foreshadowed the ark in which the remains of the human race and the seed of succeeding ages, so to speak, was to be preserved. And then we have Peter Conestor in his book Historia Scholastica. And what happened in those days is that Christian scholars would write the equivalent of encyclopedias. So this is his attempt to write a thorough history of a scholastic history, the history of written humanity, and basically pointed out there that he agreed with Augustine's interpretation of Genesis 6 through 9. And probably the most famous of the early church scholars to write an encyclopedia was Vincent of Beauvais, writing in France in what's called the Speculum Historicale. This is the biggest and most extensive encyclopedia written in the Middle Ages. And so he wrote a comprehensive review of all the flood interpretations of Christian scholars since the birth of the church. So in this exhaustive encyclopedia, he basically surveys what all these people believed about the flood. What's interesting, there's nothing in his encyclopedia to indicate that any Christian scholar explicitly believe in a global flood. So this is a direct refutation, which is here from Terry Mortensen. So next week, we'll get into Thomas, not next week, 2 weeks from now, we'll look at Thomas Aquinas, we're going to look at Martin Luther, and we're going to look at John Calvin. Why am I going to focus on those three? Those are the three that are most frequently cited as believing that the flood of Noah was global. And I'll document for you, it's all based on people looking at the term worldwide as if that's synonymous with global. The truth is, nothing in the writings of Calvin, Luther, or Aquinas would give any indication that they believe the flood was globally extensive. So yeah, again a reminder, next Sunday we'll not have class. My wife and I are actually going to be driving to Tucson to attend the wedding of a member of our scholar community. He's one of the associate scholars. So we have a segment of our scholar community for young men and women who are close to getting their doctoral degree. And what we do is we actually, in the process of getting the doctoral degree, we team them up with a mentor, one or two mentors that have been in their discipline for 20, 30, 40 years, and actually mentor them and help them finish their PhD and then get launched in their career. And this particular young man, his family lives here in the Glendora area, and he has already set up Zoom meetings where he's basically having me talk to scientists he's met that he thinks would be ideal members of our scholar community. So I'm encouraged that this graduate student is actually recruiting his professors to become part of our team. And also he says, when he's pursuing a PhD in genetics, and he says, I want to use my genetics as an evangelistic tool to bring people to faith in Jesus Christ. So yeah, we really want to encourage him. So that's what I'll be doing next Sunday. Because I think he's one of the rising stars that we need to be looking at and really trying to help us build our community. If you haven't heard, one of the goals we have at Reasons to Believe is to build up a community of 1,000 doctoral level scholars that are passionate about bringing their peers to faith in Christ and adhere to biblical inerrancy. Because we believe if we can get 1,000 scholars around the world actually actively bringing their peers to faith in Christ, this is going to have a trickle-down effect that I think is going to bless the whole church worldwide. Say, how close are you to that? Well, we launched this venture about 6 years ago, and people said, this is great. You've got 6 scholars. How are you ever going to get to 1,000? We said, well, we're going to work on a little bit at a time, but we're now at 300. So it is progressing. And we notice is, as it grows, it's accelerating. And the whole point is, I've known lots of evangelical Christian scholars, but I've noticed they've not been willing to visibly partner with us because they're concerned about what they're going to get from their peers. But our feeling is, if we can get several hundred, they can say, hey, I'm no longer the only one. I remember speaking on university campuses, and there'd be a professor who'd come up to me and said, I'm so glad you're here on this campus. I'm the only Christian professor here on the campus. I said, you can't be, because that gentleman over there told me he was the only Christian professor on the campus. You two need to get together and have lunch. And so our whole point is, if we can build up a significant number, this is going to help people who are Christians in academia realize, you know, I no longer need to be afraid of being isolated amongst all my peers. This is a movement that I can be part of. The other thing that really excites me, the scariest place to speak about the Christian faith is on your campus. What we're now seeing in our scholar community is that people get together and say, I'll speak on your university campus if you'll speak on my university campus. I mean, if you go to another university campus, they can't fire you. You're not even on the staff there. And so it's a way that they can engage one another. This is also working at government research labs. One last story before we do the Q&A. I remember speaking at a large government lab. In fact, it was at NASA. And the director came up to me and said, this talk you're going to be giving on science and the Christian faith, this is a government lab. We don't let you use the word God. This is a government lab. And I said, wait a minute. I don't see that anywhere in the Constitution or the Bill of Rights that you can forbid me from using the word God in a talk. He says, I don't care about the Constitution. I don't care about the Bill of Rights. This is a government lab. You can't use the word God. I said, well, how about if I talk about the causal agent beyond space and time that created space and time and designed the universe in which we can live and enjoy? He says, yeah, you can do that. So that was wonderful. I actually got to define God every time I was speaking in that talk. Okay. As usual, we'll take questions from the online audience as well as people here or in person. Looks like you got an online question.
Make sure we're on here. Just a reminder for those in the audience, you can follow along the questions on your cell phone at paradoxes.org. So, or if you don't want to come back here, you can write it yourself and send it, and we'll read it. But I think we have a question. Come on, Al.
First off, Doctor, I want to thank you for all of your. I want to thank you for all of your books that you've produced and still will be around to produce for a long time, hopefully. I have two quick questions. One is, there used to be on the Paradox website post COVID, there used to be a Bach concerto that was an introduction. We played in the background while we waited for the session to start, and then it disappeared. I was wondering who selected the concerto, because it was nice to listen to waiting for the session. And I was wondering if it returned, and also if you're familiar with any. Bach was a very religious composer, and he said his inspiration came from God, and he dedicated his music to God, and also admonished people to study as hard as he could to be able to produce such a glorious set of music and everything. I was wondering if there's any quotes that you have that you might recall from Bach that you might have to share.
Well, so, I come from a family of musicians and artists. I'm kind of the black sheep of the family. I became a scientist instead of a musician or artist. They would be qualified to answer that question. What I do know, I know enough about music to realize that many famous composers indeed were inspired by their Christian faith in the music they composed. Probably the best known one would be Handel and his Messiah. He made that declaration very clear, that it was an inspiration he got from his Christian faith that motivated him to do the Messiah. And I think one of the testimonies of that is how quickly he put the Messiah together. That's a very complex piece, but the speed with which he put it together and had all the music composed, I think it would be a challenge just to pick the passages out of the Bible that he picked. That's one of the remarkable things I see about the Messiah. You know, forget the music. Just look at the passages of scriptures he chose to put to music and how beautifully that tells the whole story of the gospel message, Old and New Testament. Yeah, I think it would take me just that much time to just to read through the Bible and come up with those selections. He not only did that, he put it all to music. And if you ever listen to the Messiah, it's an amazing piece. But he's not alone. Beethoven and Bach also made the same comments, that it was their relationship with Jesus Christ that was a source of their inspiration. But hey, I'm not a musician. Taught to a composer, I think you'll get a much more complete story.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, Q. So I've been reading through Acts, and I noticed like the sermons of Peter and of Stephen, you know, very long, detailed dialogue and sermons. So I was just wondering, you know, how those were recorded, or how, or, you know, were they recorded verbatim? Was someone writing it down, or was that just a paraphrase? And that, you know, that's kind of a stumbling block, I think, for some people. Is like, how was this recorded? Was it handed down through verbal tradition, or was it actually recorded at the moment? So maybe you can comment on what you know about that.
Yeah, good question. I think the answer is, Steve, that it probably was memorized word for word, and then shortly thereafter, it was put down in writing. and then they figured out what to include, what not to include. So, for example, when you hear Stephen's speech in the book of Acts, we don't know if that's the entirety of his speech. It may have been just picking the highlights out of that speech, so it could have been longer. And I think the problem is we are very skeptical today that people could have that kind of memorization power. I think in the 21st century, memorization capability is quickly disappearing for a simple reason. None of us needs it. You want to record something, you turn your smartphone on, you get it recorded, and that smartphone will even put it into text for you. You don't even have to transcribe it. So I think we've all gotten lazy because of our technology. And moreover, if I want to, I don't really have to remember Bible verses anymore. I just kind of put it in my computer. It pops right up. I get it in 40 different translations. And so the motivation to memorize is gone. But when you don't have a written language, or you don't have a large number of the people in the population that are literate, what you discover is that they have amazing memorization capabilities. So, and I'm old enough that when I went through public school, I had to memorize, about 500 lines. We pulled it off. Don't ask me to repeat it today, because I have really no need for that. But my colleague, Fazal Rana, he says, yes, I was required to memorize about 2,500 lines of Shakespeare's plays. The amazing thing about my colleague, Fuzz, he still has those lines memorized. So, but the reason why, he says, I use them. Whenever I'm writing, I'll put the old line from Shakespeare in. If you use it, you remember it. If you don't use it, you forget it. So, it may be worthwhile to put your smartphone down once in a while and be able to use your brain the way God had it set up. There's actually a research paper pointing out the alarming trend of people under 30 not being able to navigate. If they don't have a phone, they get lost. Those of us who are older can remember when if you had to drive around the LA basin, you had to pull out your big stack of Thomas guides. How many of you still have Thomas guides? I got rid of all my Thomas guides. So several of you still have Thomas guides? Okay. Well, if anything ever happens to your smartphone, you'll be able to get around. The whole idea of reading maps, I'm actually working with my son saying once in a while, actually look at a map. Put your phone down, look at a map, and figure out where you need to go. But the amazing thing is I took my son's hiking in the wilds of British Columbia last year. You look at the map to see where you're going on the trail. It's one trail we took, the smartphone guided us all the way. They actually had a cell tower there that they could get access to. But I also remember one time we were climbing this mountain and this guide insisted that we had to get all the way to the summit. My wife wasn't really sure, but we finally got to the summit. And what did the guide do? Pulled out her smartphone and immediately called her mother and had a conversation. Says that's the only places in the entire area where I get cell service. So the top of the highest mountain in the region. So she dragged us up to that mountain so she could have a conversation with her mother. But the bottom line is, I believe that, for example, the book of Job was written 400 or 500 years before Hebrew became a written language. How was it preserved? Word for word memorization. Now, years ago, we had a missionary who occasionally attended this class. His name was Don Richardson, and he wrote the book Peace Child, was made into a movie. He also wrote a book, Eternity in Their Hearts. And what he documented is that when you're a missionary to these Stone Age primitive tribes, their ability to memorize is phenomenal. That's how they preserve the important stuff. They basically tell stories to one another. They get the children to memorize the stories word for word, so it will be preserved and passed on to the next generation. You say, well, how many words are they able to memorize? 30,000 words can be put to memory word for word. And says, you'll never find that in New York City or Los Angeles because nobody needs that skill. But you do find it in these tribes where there's no written language, where there's no technology, where that's the only way they can preserve what they think is important. So, The idea that the speech that Stephen gave in the book of Acts was put to memory and later put down in written form is certainly not beyond the capability of people at that time. I mean, if you read that, it's only one chapter. So, and there was a young man that was in this class a few years ago, and what he did is he came up in front of the class and basically gave us all a gift. He read for us from memory the entire book of Titus, word for word. He basically said that, you know, it's a skill we've lost these days, but hey, I got it all memorized in one day. He devoted one day to memorizing the entire book of Titus. He invited all of us to open up our Bibles and see if he made any mistakes. He didn't make a single mistake. He had all three chapters memorized word for word. So, now then, maybe we can lay out a challenge for the class here. Would anyone like to duplicate that feat here? If you do, I'll give you some time here in front of the class to pick a book of the Bible and memorize it word for word. And if you pick the book of Jude, that's going to be fairly easy. I will not give you time to go through the entire book of Ezekiel. That would take quite a while to do that here in class, but pick a few chapters. So if anyone wants to pick up that challenge, we'll give them time to demonstrate that here in the class. Okay, next question.
We got a question from Doug McComb. It's a language question dealing with Aramaic and Greek. He asked, I understand that Koine Greek, there is no indefinite article, A, as in here, A star guided the Magi. Is this a translation problem? Matthew was written in Aramaic.
Yeah, well, that's true, but notice that the word is star singular. So you don't even need the indefinite article to realize we're talking one star. It's star singular, not stars plural.
Question about the flood. There are so many disparate cultures, both geographically and culturally, that have a flood story in their quote-unquote mythology. My question is this. I believe Mesoamerica has a flood story.
America have a flood story. There's a book that I cite in my book on Noah's flood where an author accumulated 300 flood stories from the ancient cultures of just North and South America. Forget Europe, forget Asia, forget Africa, just North and South America, the native tribes, you'll see 300 different stories about a flood.
No.
Flood stories are far more common in the ancient world than creation stories. Mm-hmm. And one reason that I think this is significant is the amazing similarities amongst all these flood stories. In fact, I'm going to present for you a little chart that basically shows you what all these flood stories believed and what they did not believe. It's interesting that all of these stories depart significantly from what we see in Genesis 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11. But they have a lot in common. The fact that they have so much in common means they must be referring to a single flood. Because one of the skeptical responses is to say, yes, the reason for all these flood stories, floods are common. And so wherever there's a flood in an ancient culture, it gets incorporated into their story. Then if that's the case, you'd expect these 400 flood stories in the different cultures of the world to show significant differences with one another. The fact that they're so similar to one another, the fact that the departure from what we see in the Bible gets greater and greater as you go to greater and greater distances from the Persian Gulf area, the greater the distance, the greater the distortion, the greater the time separation, the greater the distortion. That's like the kind of like the game of telephone. The more people you got in line, the greater the departure from the original story that was told over the telephone. But all of this is cited as evidence. We really are looking at a single flood account. Otherwise, you really can't explain the similarities.
Got it. Thank you.
Okay. Here's a question online from Susan Lamb. Any idea how many years a short duration nova can live, like many centuries, or millennia, or more?
So what was the first part of that question?
She asked, do you have any idea how many years a short duration nova can live, like in centuries or millennia?
Recurring nova. How long can a star last as a recurring nova? Well, to get the recurring nova effect, you need a star that's stealing mass from a star that's orbiting it. And yes, if you wait long enough, there will no longer be sufficient mass taken from the partner star to sustain the recurrences. You say, how much time we're talking about? It's in the millions of years. So we're not talking a short period of time.
Okay. Thomas Long goes back on that question again. Not quite what I was asking. All the counts of the tribes of Israel in Numbers, the book of Numbers, end in zero and are even numbers. This seems near impossible. Is there an explanation?
Yes, there is an explanation. The Bible rounds numbers off. And so, and you do see that. I mean, for example, in the New Testament, you got both Paul and I think it's Stephen talking about how long the children of Israel were in the land of Egypt, and one of them says 400 years, the other one says 440 years. Well, it might have been 438 years. One's rounding it off to one place, one is rounding it off to two places, and likewise we see throughout the Bible that it will round things off. Now, to give you an example, a lot of skeptics will critique the Bible saying it gets the value of pi wrong. It says that the circumference of a particular basin is three times the diameter. Well, it is three times the one place of the decimal, which is amusing because I've seen some apologists saying, well, if the basin had a rim that was a little more than 4 inches thick, we can get the answer to be three if you have the outside or the inside diameter and the outside, or the outside diameter and the inside circumference, we can get the value of pi to within five places of the decimal if we make the bath and say, wait a minute, it's easier than that. The text is simply rounding it off to one place of the decimal. And so round-offs are quite common in the Bible. In fact, I don't know of any figure, numbers given in the Bible that's not rounded off unless the number is small. So when it talks about the sons of Israel, yeah, the number 12 is accurate, really is 12. So, but you could also say of Jacob, he had about 10 children. That would still be an accurate statement, even though the real number is 12.
All right. At risk of offending YouTube, we have a COVID question. Is that, you want to take it?
A question about COVID?
Yeah.
Well, let's hear the question
okay.
First. I do reserve the right to deny it.
let's see. Hold it. 1 second here. Okay. Have you changed your views on COVID origins or vaccine safety and efficacy since your initial comments on these topics? Is the RSV vaccine based on a different technology? And I think that's messenger RNA also.
Messenger RNA, correct, yeah. Yeah, we have changed our position because when this whole COVID virus came out, there was a strong denial from the governments of the world that it did not come from an accident in a Wuhan lab. There's now evidence that that's probably the case. It did come from an accident in the Wuhan lab. So yeah, the story of the origin of the virus has changed. The nature of the virus, it's a coronavirus. Likewise, when you have a common cold, that's also a coronavirus. And so I remember years ago when COVID first hit, there were people predicting that maybe COVID would evolve like the common cold, where you're basically going to be exposed to it every year, but that the virus would evolve to a point where instead of killing people, it just makes your life miserable. And that's actually good for the virus because it's able to spread more rapidly, because if all you do is have a bad cold, you'll probably go to the office and try to work and you'll infect all your fellow employees. But if you're too sick to even get out of bed, that's not going to happen. So it's not a surprise that with some of these viruses, the effect of the virus on your health also evolves over time. Now, the question also said, could I comment on the messenger RNA vaccines? Well, there's basically two kinds of vaccines we have today. If you were to go back a decade ago, what they would do is they would take the virus, weaken the virus, and give you a shot. And your body would basically build the defenses to deal with the weakened virus. And by doing that, it would protect you against where you get the full-blown virus. And so you'd often would get a shot, and maybe for a few hours or a day, you feel not quite right because you're being exposed to weakened nature of the virus. But the advantage of the shot is, hey, you might have a day where you're not feeling the greatest, but that will protect you from really having a bad case of the flu. And so, but the problem is it's a virus. These viruses evolve, and they evolve quickly. And so, for example, they recommend if you're over 60 years of age, you should get a flu shot every year. It's not the same flu shot. What they do is they figure out the way that the flu virus has evolved over the past 12 months, and they'll give you a different shot literally every year to deal with the evolving nature of the flu virus. COVID is also a coronavirus. It evolves rapidly. And so what they're now recommending is that you need to get a shot, say once every year to deal with the evolving changes in the coronavirus. Now, the messenger RNA is not a weakened virus. Messenger RNA is where they basically give you a shot that helps your cells in the body identify the spike protein. That's the spike on the virus that's actually able to penetrate the cell. And so it basically recognizes that spike and basically develops the appropriate defenses. And there are people, virologists, who are saying, we like the messenger RNA vaccine because you don't get exposed to the virus at all. You're basically being inoculated to help the cells identify when the virus is coming. And so people say, well, aren't there side effects? Some people have side effects to the messenger RNA. By the way, some people have side effects to the weakened. If your immune system is really compromised, getting a shot where you have a weakened virus could be enough to overcome your immune system. And so basically your doctor says, you know what, your immune system's too compromised, or they give you an even weaker version of it. Bottom line is we now have more options than we had in the past, and that's why they ask you questions. I got to tell you this. First time I had my COVID shot, they said, you're over 70. They put me in a special line where they would ask you more detailed questions because, I'm, quote, at a bigger risk for side effects. So they put me in this little room, and I had to go through this written test and check everything off. And then they wanted to know about my psychological state. Am I depressed? Ever thought about suicide? Am I getting along okay with my wife? And so I answered all those questions. And then the last set of questions was, Mr. Ross, are you pregnant? I said, no, I'm not pregnant. They said, we got a follow-up question. Are you nursing? I said, no, I'm not nursing. That was hard for me not to turn it into a joke, but I knew if I did, I was going to be there a lot longer, so I just played straight. But I did tell the nurse there, you are aware of my age, right? Yes. You know, even if I was a female, I'd still be answering these questions the same way. Why is this here, even here? She says, this is California. This is the way it is. So, but the next time I had my shot, they didn't ask me if I was pregnant or nursing. So, but the whole point is, when it comes to any health issue, in fact, there's a law right now. If you ever get a prescription drug, the law requires that they have to list all the side effects. And virtually every drug I've ever used, it actually says possibility of death, okay? Well, guess what? There's a possibility of death no matter what drug you take. I mean, we're all going to die, right? And so, but yeah, it can get a bit absurd, but it is, the whole point is you need to realize, as with any medication, any mental shot. But you know, it's encouraging to me when they say, this is a messenger RNA virus you're going to take, and given your situation, there's only one chance in 151 million you're going to have any side effects. And I say, well, with those kinds of odds, give me the shot. So.
You ready for your last question?
Yes.
It's actually a comment from Mark Wilburn. I think it's Lambda CDM Big Bang model doesn't include the extra spatial dimensions that you spoke of. That comes from superstring theory, which has been abandoned due to no evidence coming out of CERN. You want to comment back on that?
Sure. Well, there are many models that are out there that are working to take our particle creation model, our cosmic creation model, and make them compatible. I mean, we're here, so they have to be compatible. So the question is, which models of cosmology and which models of particle physics can they actually be completely integrated in a way so that life can exist in the universe? And current cosmic creation model basically doesn't worry about the extra space dimensions, because in the present era, they really don't play any role. What particle theoreticians have pointed out, we need them when the particles are first being formed. We need them to explain unified field theory, how the universe begins with one force, then has two forces, three forces, and four forces. When it goes from one force to two forces, this is when you have several of the dimensions of space that stop expanding. But it happens when the universe is only 10 to the minus 43 seconds old. And so those space dimensions are 20 orders of magnitude smaller than the diameter of an electron. So here we are 14 billion years later. We don't really need to worry about those space dimensions. They're playing no significant role today. But they did play a significant role when the universe was 10 to the minus 43 seconds old. And yeah, the question is making the point, hey, we do have models that don't require these extra space dimensions, and we have a lot of models that do. And we have no proof, for example, that string theory is correct. And as it is, there are, you know, more than 10 to the 100 viable string theories. It is true that all string theories do posit that there are six tiny space dimensions to accompany the three large dimensions, but it's not just string theory or superstring theory that has these six dimensions. There are many models. And I don't know of any viable particle creation model that completely fits with a cosmic creation model that doesn't need these extra space dimensions. So it's not just one model that needs them. We do, but there are lots of competing models out there, and who says we have all the models? It's just like the Big Bang model. People think the Big Bang model is one model. No, it's a whole family of models. And what we're trying to do as astronomers is to determine which of those family of models is the correct model. But that's happened many times in the past 100 years, where we've gone from a family of models, the models shrink. But when we get to the smaller family of models, we discover that we can diversify the models and get a bunch more. This is the mark of the success of the model. The more we learn, the more constrained the models become, But the more we learn, the more variety of models we discover. All science works that way. So there's always more than one model, but you know you're on the right track where the models all cluster very closely together. And the more you learn, the more closely they cluster together. And that's also happening on the particle creation thing. But we're much farther ahead determining the correct cosmic creation model than we are the correct particle creation model. Things are much more challenging at the particle level.
Well, thank you, Hugh. And we are done in here for the day, except for your closing prayer.
Okay, great. Father in heaven, we thank you for this season that we're in, when people are thinking about Christmas, they're thinking about the meaning of Christmas, they're asking questions. Father, I pray that you would equip all of us here, based on what's been written in the gospel accounts, that we may be ready at any time to answer people's questions about Christmas, the real meaning of Christmas, and how we should respond to that true meaning. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you.